When he saw Jesus, he cried out and fell at his feet, shouting at the top of his voice, "What do you want with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I beg you, don't torture me." For Jesus had commanded the impure spirit to come out of the man. Many times it had seized him, and though he was chained hand and foot and kept under guard, he had broken his chains and had been driven by the demon into solitary places. Jesus asked him, "What is your name?" "Legion," he replied, because many demons had gone into him. And they begged Jesus repeatedly not to order them to go into the abyss. A large herd of pigs was feeding there on the hillside. The demons begged Jesus to let them go into the pigs, and he gave them permission. When the demons came out of the man, they went into the pigs, and the herd rushed down the steep bank into the lake and was drowned. When those tending the pigs saw what had happened, they ran off and reported this in the town and countryside, and the people went out to see what had happened. When they came to Jesus, they found the man from whom the demons had gone out sitting at Jesus' feet, dressed and in his right mind, and they were afraid. Those who had seen it told the people how the demon-possessed man had been cured. Then all the people of the region of the Gerasenes asked Jesus to leave them because they were overcome with fear. So he got into the boat and left. The man from whom the demons had gone out begged to go with him, but Jesus sent him away, saying, "Return home and tell how much God has done for you." So the man went away and told all over town how much Jesus had done for him. The word of the Lord.
Thanks be to God. You may be seated, and if you're sitting down, would you make sure your Bibles are open to Luke 8 and the story that Steve has just read to us. We're in a section of Luke's gospel that is asking the question, who is in control? How much authority does Jesus really have? And we might have lost a bit of our momentum in the study of Luke's gospel because of the last couple of weeks. We've had a great retreat, and we obviously didn't look at Luke's gospel that week, and then last week was Easter. And so it's been a while, and we're in a section of Luke's gospel where he bunches together four miracles to make the one simple point that Jesus has control. He has authority. A few weeks ago, I taught on the section of Jesus calming the storm that showed his authority over nature. Next Sunday, Reed is going to be teaching about two miracles, the miracle of a woman who is diseased, I'm getting a little echo up here, and Jesus heals her of a hemorrhage, and then also the raising of the daughter of Jairus, the raising of the dead, and then here today, Jesus' authority over the Satan, over the demonic, over spiritual forces. It's a fascinating story in the life of Jesus. It is the longest and most vivid account in the Bible of an exorcism. In fact, it's in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. They all give it ample room in their Gospels. It is the first exorcism in Gentile territory. The passage is remarkable, and it teaches us something, number one, about the reality of evil, secondly, about the pattern of evil, and thirdly, about the victory or deliverance from evil. So there you've got kind of where we're going to go just the next couple of minutes, the pattern of evil, and then also the reality of evil, the pattern of evil, and then the defeat of evil. So let's begin. The reality of evil. Many modern people would say it's just silly to believe in demons or the devil. They would say we're way too sophisticated for that, we're way beyond that. And well, maybe. If you say, "I don't believe in God, I reject the possibility of any supernatural being," then most likely you will not believe in a real personal evil. Your world is a closed system. You are a materialist. There's no room for God. There's no room for Satan. But if you open the door in your life and say, "You know, maybe I believe in God," and obviously many of us here this morning definitely say that, "Yeah, I believe in God," then you'll also have to allow for the possibility of a real personal evil, the devil or demons. The Bible clearly teaches that there is a real personal evil called Satan or the devil or demons, and in our time it can be made light of in a lot of different ways. I would recommend to all of you, if you've not read C.S. Lewis's The Screwtape Letters, it's both humorous and insightful about a fictional account of an older demon giving instructions to a younger devil on how to mess up Christians. And at one point, the senior devil Screwtape says to the junior devil Wormwood, "The fact that devils are predominantly comic figures in the modern imagination will help you. If any faint suspicion of your existence begins to arise in his mind, suggest to him a picture of something in red tights." So can't you just see it? A cute little guy in red tights with a pitchfork and maybe a couple of little horns. And persuade him that since he cannot believe in that, therefore he cannot believe in you. And there is a real tendency in our world to kind of make it a comic character, Satan, but the scripture doesn't do that. People in the first century understood the difference between illness or mental disease or physical disease and the demonic. There was a good understanding that they were not one and the same. Matthew's gospel makes this very clear. Jesus went throughout Galilee, teaching in their synagogues, proclaiming the good news of the kingdom, and healing every disease and sickness among the people. News about him spread all over Syria, and people brought to him all who were ill with various diseases. Now, I want you to see the distinction between different types of physical ailments and mental ailments and then demonic. They're not just all lumped together. Those suffering severe pain, the demon-possessed, those having seizures, the paralyzed, and he healed them all. Now, we don't know a great deal about the demonic. Only what the Bible tells us, and to be perfectly frank, it doesn't tell us all that much. The Bible does not clearly, in my mind, distinguish between possession, obsession with being oppressed by demons. These are somewhat fluid categories. One way to translate this word, would you look in your Bibles that I hope are open, verse 27, that the man was demon-possessed. That could also be translated quite literally, he was demonized. That is, he was under the influence of one, or in this case, more than one, evil spirits. He was demonized. They're referred to as legion, and the backdrop here would be the Roman legion armies that would speak of many, many troops. And we don't know exactly how many demons are demonizing this man, but we do know that he is definitely under the influence of more than one demon. I want you to notice in the passage that Steve just read us, it is a very, very public event. Everyone in the area knows this poor, tormented man. It is really a tragic situation. This man is in real turmoil and real trouble in his life. We're not exactly sure how he got to this place, but he is evidently well-known and very, very public. And some of you might say, oh, gosh, see, that just seems very far-fetched. I would say not so quick. There was a guy that, if you can remember back, not too many years, who got known, he got dubbed as the naked guy who walked around Berkeley for many, many years. He had a real name. His name was Andrew Martinez. He wore his backpack and his shoes, and that is all. And Berkeley, being Berkeley, allowed him to do this because they didn't know how to say no to anything. And he did this for quite some time. Our speaker at the retreat, Mark Labberton, who's a professor at Fuller Seminary and just did a great job, he was pastor of First Presbyterian Church Berkeley, which is just right adjacent to the campus, for 16 years. And he told some of us, he said it was really strange, but this guy would frequently come to church naked. Don't try that here. But but he would, and the ushers would just kind of politely turn him around and get him out. The story is not that far-fetched. We really know very little about what demons can and cannot do, and in particular, their relationship to our bodies. Now, which brings us to probably the question that's burning on everybody's mind. What's up with the pigs? What about the pigs? We know from Mark's version of this story that there are 2,000 pigs. That's a lot of bacon, and it's big business in this part of the world. And what's going on with the pigs? The demons are evidently recognizing that Jesus has absolute authority, and they do not want to be thrown into the abyss. The abyss is hell. Matthew's gospel adds a little bit of information. He says that they didn't want to be thrown into hell before the appointed time. In other words, before the time of judgment. And so they're going into the pigs. Now, I this week, in honoring you as listeners to this teaching, have read a lot of scholars and their opinions on the pigs. And I've come up with, there's about 2,000 interpretations of the 2,000 pigs. Very, very confusing. So my take on it is simply this. My best guess is the demons are trying to avoid judgment in the abyss. And it's also, at the same time, a wonderful, invisible proof that there's a real miracle, that this demonized man has truly been set free, and the demons have gone elsewhere, at least for a short time. What Jesus is pointing out in this miracle is while the forces of evil are real and strong, they are no match for his power, for his authority. And while Jesus is outnumbered by the demons, he is not overmatched. God is ultimately in control. And that's really the point, a huge part of the point of this passage. And I would suggest to all of us this morning that it is naive and wrong to try and live the Christian life without an acute awareness of the reality of the attacks of the evil one, that Satan is a real in our world. Well, what about the pattern of evil? Well, in a word, the pattern of evil is complex. And one of the things I want to open up for you in the next couple of minutes is to think about evil, to think about the evil one, the attacks of Satan, and to think about the very complex nature of how this might work in our lives and in our church. Ephesians chapter 6, verse 12, Paul says, "Our struggle is not against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the authorities, against the powers of this dark world, against the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly realms." And then we get a wonderful description of how Christians can fight the spiritual battle with the armor of God in that very same chapter. The Apostle Peter weighs in a similar warning sort of way, and he says to believers, "Be alert and sober-minded. Your enemy, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion looking for someone to devour. Resist him, standing firm in the faith." Eugene Peterson's paraphrase of the New Testament, the Message, he paraphrases this verse very liberally, but I like it. He says, "The devil is poised to pounce and would like nothing better than to catch you napping." I think he kind of captures the idea of what Peter is getting at. One of the things that Christians must consider when thinking about evil and the pattern of evil in our lives and the influence of Satan in our lives is the tremendously complex nature of spiritual warfare. We have to look behind this narrative. One of the things that this narrative just begs for answers for, and we don't have it in the narrative, is how did this man get to this place? How did he all of a sudden become demonized? How did he start living in caves and crying out and running around naked? What happened? Spiritual warfare is incredibly complex. Wouldn't it be nice if we could just simplistically say, as the old comedian said, you know, "The devil made me do it," and then just be done with it? It's not that simple. A very, very important spiritual principle for us to get a hold of this morning is that Satan takes no territory in our lives that we do not voluntarily give him. Satan takes no territory in our lives or in our church that we don't voluntarily give him. And yet we're involved. Each one is tempted, James says, when by his own evil desire he's enticed and dragged away. Many years ago, I was a young college student living in Ocean Beach, San Diego, a little suburb. And I was just thinking about this when I gave this illustration in the first service. I had more people comment on this than the whole sermon, so go figure. But I lived in a little cottage with my roommate. The whole cottage rented for $100 a month. It was three blocks from the beach. And my half was $50 and his half was $50. It was a long time ago. It was great. You could live really cheaply then. But we lived there in this little cottage, three blocks from the beach, my roommate and I. And one evening we were in the midst of doing whatever we were doing and finally went to bed. And the front door was left wide open. And we shared one room in the back. And in the middle of the night, somebody came in. This was not the greatest neighborhood. Somebody came in and stole some of our stuff. Now, fortunately, we didn't have a lot of stuff worth stealing at that point in our lives. But they took some of our stuff. And in the morning, we, of course, were absolutely outraged that someone had stole our stuff. But the point is, we left the door wide open. The process of temptation, the attacks of Satan, our own complicity in sin is very, very complex. And one of the problems is that at times we leave the front door of our lives open to the attacks of the evil one. The Bible does not reduce our problems and our sin to a single issue, but rather a complex kind of interlocking matrix of ways that mess up our lives and potentially our church. The problem of evil is both out there. There is a real Satan out there, but it's also in here. And that out there-ness and the in-here-ness of it make it complex and at times hard to figure out in our own lives. We do know that demonic forces stir up and aggravate the problems and sinful propensities in our life. And so Satan is looking, the demons are looking, and the evil one is looking for open doors in our life and in our church. How did this poor man become demonized? Well, we don't really know. But we do know that the evil one was opportunistic in his life. Again, Satan takes no territory that we don't voluntarily give him. And in the New Testament, we get what I'm going to call hints about how this works. Hints of how the process and the complexity might work of Satan invading our life. I want to just give you a couple of verses and show you how this might work. Paul is writing to the church at Ephesus. And he's in a section here, I can't read all of chapter 4, but he's really concerned about relationships in the church and how people use their mouth and the problems that might create. And he says this, "Therefore, each of you must put off falsehood and speak truthfully to your neighbor, for we're all members of one body, one church." And then he quotes Psalm 4, "In your anger, do not sin. Do not let the sun go down while you are still angry." That's kind of a good principle, certainly works in marriage. Don't go to bed and mad. Maybe it works that way in church life too. The principle here is we're all funky. Funky is a theological term. Paul is very practical, instructing the believers at Ephesus about getting mad at each other in church life. This whole part of this chapter talks about that. I love the Bible. It is so realistic. It is never naive. It's never Pollyannish. And Paul is addressing the fact that people have tensions in church life. Anyone here ever get mad? Ever get bothered, ever get irritated by another brother or sister at Santa Barbara Community Church? This is not a time to answer out loud. It's a rhetorical question. But we know enough about church life, and we know enough about the reality of our own funkiness, again, that we know that happens because we're sinful. We do this because we're selfish, we're critical, we're touchy, we are easily offended, and so far the problem Paul is addressing is in all of us. It's in here. But then he adds the little words at the end of this verse that I just neglected to read. Do you see them? Look at them. "And do not give the devil a foothold." So out of our own selfishness, our own touchiness, our own critical nature, our own just how weird we can all be, that's something that happens in here. But then Paul says, but be careful, because if you open the door, the evil one will get a foothold in your life or a foothold in your church. Scary. Don't give the devil a foothold. The problem of evil is both out there and inside of us. Do you see how complex this can become? An opportunistic devil is looking for a foothold to create havoc in your life and in our church. He is hoping that doors will be left open. Paul says in 2 Corinthians 2, "Let's be careful that in order that Satan might not outwit us, for we are not unaware of his schemes or his scheming." Well, I think sometimes we are. Paul is pleading with the Christians at Corinth, hey, be aware, there's a schemer out there. Sometimes we are a bit naive. Let me ask a question again, one that is not to be answered out loud, but you need to apply this teaching right now. How might the evil one harm the work of God in your life? How might the evil one harm the work of God in your life? And to go a little further, how might the evil one harm the work of God and create dissension in his church, in this church? Satan wants a foothold. The destroyer wants to destroy. The lion is prowling. The Satan is scheming. The writer of Hebrews says, "Make every effort to live at peace with everyone and to be holy. Without holiness, no one can see the Lord. See to it that no one falls short of the grace of God. Now watch this next section. And that no bitter root grows up and causes trouble and defile many. Would you look again at what I hope is your Bible? It's open there, verse 29. This demonized man, the demons at some point drive him where? The end of that verse, do you see it? Into solitary places. One of the ways that Satan creates havoc in our life, in our church, is driving us to solitary places. I don't mean literally the desert. But I mean the solitary places in our own mind, those corners, those nooks, those crannies, where our angers and our fears and our self-centeredness can develop into a root of bitterness, and they can take root and they can grow. And this happens individually and corporately. Let me show you just one other hint. And we could do this all morning, but just one more. It's a hint of how Satan works and the complexity of this whole thing. Paul is giving instructions, and the instructions you probably are familiar with are very, very practical. They're very earthy, nitty-gritty types of stuff of qualifications for leaders in a local church, in particular elders and deacons in 1 Timothy. And he says this, and I'm cutting at the end of a long list of qualifications, but he said, he, this would be this potential elder, must also have a good reputation with outsiders so that he will not fall into disgrace. Okay, good enough. This has to do with social relationships. He's to have a good reputation with outside. And then watch this, and fall into the devil's trap. And most of us kind of go, huh? What's the devil's trap? Again, the problem is both in here. I need to have a good reputation as one of your elders. I need to have a good reputation both in the community and among before you. Because if I don't, that's my problem, my reputation. If I don't have that reputation, if there's something askew in my life, that's an opportunity for an opportunistic Satan to lure me and potentially our church into a trap. Demonic forces stir up and aggravate all the sinful propensities that we have in our life. The evil one would like us to blame everyone and every personal problem that we have and every problem we have in the church on someone else besides ourselves. To point their finger and say, oh, they're the problem. They're the evil one. That's what Satan wants us to do. Big quote. Got to put this up there. Alexander Solzhenitsyn, the famous Russian dissident who was a believer, spent many years in the Soviet penal system, in the Gulag. And at one point, he says this as he comes to one of the great realizations of his life. It was only when I lay there on rotting prison straw that I sensed within myself the first stirrings of good. Gradually, it was disclosed to me that the line separating good and evil passes not through states, nor between classes, nor between political parties, and I would add, nor in churches, but right through every human heart, through all human hearts. If there was only evil people somewhere insidiously committing evil deeds, and it was necessary only to separate them from the rest of us and destroy them, but the line dividing good and evil cuts through the heart of every human being. And who is willing to destroy a piece of his own heart? It's both out there and in here. The pattern of evil is almost always gradual. Satan does not come to us overtly, but slowly sucks us in as we give him territory, as we leave the door open in our lives. Let me give a couple of illustrations, hypothetical. You take a young man or a young woman who graduates from college or maybe business school. They're looking forward to having a good life that honors God and serving him in the business community. Having a marriage, maybe some children, and being involved in their local church and in the work of the kingdom. They're very optimistic, and their life is pretty well balanced. Fast forward 15 to 20 years. And that same man or that same woman who's now been pursuing business so relentlessly is working about 70 hours a week. They're completely out of touch with their wife. They're not serving the Lord. They're not involved in any sort of ministry. They've kind of totally given themselves over to pursuit of this career. How did that happen? Gradually, slowly, as the door was open. Let's take the high school student, a college student who occasionally, just occasionally, looks at pornography. Not very often. Fast forward 15 or 20 years. And oftentimes we find a man who is absolutely obsessed, or should I say, possessed, on a daily basis. How did that happen? Slowly. Gradually. Take anger or bitterness in church relationships, frustration with one another, that starts maybe with just a little schism, a little, conflict, a little bit of a problem. Fast forward maybe just a few years, where a root of bitterness takes hold in a church. How does that happen? Gradually, slowly, as the door is open in our lives, and Satan loves to get a foothold. This passage teaches us about the reality of evil, the pattern of evil that is incredibly complex, and then lastly, and probably most importantly, the defeat of evil. Jesus has very clear authority, and he uses it. With a simple command, evil is defeated in this man's life. I just love it. There's no elaborate incantations. There's no working up a sweat on the part of Jesus. There's no showy ritual, just a simple authoritative deliverance. And in the end, in a way, it's interesting to think about, Jesus and this poor, tormented man somewhat trade places. At the end of Jesus' life, he is the one who cries out, my God, why have you forsaken me? Just as the naked man had cried out. Jesus is the one who ends up naked on the cross, just as this poor demonized man had been naked. Jesus is the one who ends up in a tomb, at least before the resurrection. And for our sake, to make us whole again, to bring forgiveness and restoration because of his great, great love for us. The story ends with a graphic, graphic picture of new life and forgiveness. Can you visualize it? Work with me here a minute. We just read a very wonderful narrative of deliverance. We have a man who's cutting himself, who is crying out, who has supernatural strength, who is running around naked, who is tormented by demonic forces. And what do we find at the end of the story? We find a man sitting at the feet of Jesus in his right mind. Can you picture this man? And Jesus says, return home and tell how much God has done for you. No easy task for a guy who's been through what he's been through. The people know him. They know how he got to this place. And to go home in the first century would be go home to a house undoubtedly with extended family. He wasn't going home to an apartment all by himself. He's going home to a bunch of people in a village where he knew a lot of people who'd seen this descent into Satan's control in his life. And Jesus says, go home. Tell people how much God has done for you. So many times, people will think that they are beyond saving. And I hear this frequently in our church and in the Christian community here in town. Some of you don't think you can ever be free from the failures and sins of your past. You just don't have hope that you can ever put all that junk behind you. I've had people over the years say to me frequently, Steve, you don't know the grip that sin has on me. Steve, you can't imagine how hopeless I feel because of where I have been and what I have done, or maybe where I am right now and what I'm doing right now. Bondage, scars, drug and alcohol abuse, bondage, scars from greed, selfishness, arrogance, dishonesty, bondage, scars from sexual sins, sometimes heterosexual sin, sometimes homosexual sin. that maybe you're in now or maybe you've had in your past. You say, I just can't get beyond all this. So scars that make you feel like you are disfigured beyond help. One of the reasons this story is in the New Testament is to encourage anyone who feels like that. I don't care how messed up you are. Look at this guy. Look at this demonized man who left the doors open to a legion to come into his life. Jesus has the power and the authority to forgive and to restore any of us and to send you back into your world, watch this, and into your church, forgiven, whole, to testify what God has done for you. Grace, forgiveness, restoration are at the very center of the Christian life, and the very center of the gospel. The story tells of God's love, of his desire and his authority to transform and redeem lives that are possessed by legion. And I want you to know that I'm looking right now at a group of people who, because you've given your lives to Christ, are now clothed and in your right mind. And this is the goodness of the gospel, friends. This is why we gather on Sundays, to say, wow, I know what's in here, and I know what's out there, and you can look around and say, I know what's around me, and God is so good. He wants so much to restore us and to bring us back and to heal those broken areas, those damaged areas in our life. Reed is going to come and pray in a second for us, and I just think it'd be appropriate if we could just be quiet for a moment. And would you remind yourself of what God has done for you in saving you? Would you remind yourself of what God has done for those around you? Would you remind yourself in a fresh way this morning of what God would like to do in all of our lives and in our church? Would you close doors in your life that maybe you've left open, where the robber, the thief, the destroyer would seek to come in and create havoc in your life or in our church? Let's just be quiet for a moment, and then Reed will come and pray.